We're in the second chapter of Haggai. Let me review just a little. We may keep in mind what Haggai is talking about. The Jews got back from the Babylonian captivity in 536. They built an altar to worship, and they laid the foundation of the temple, but that's when, and then they stopped there. So for 16 years, they let the temple lie waste, and they were, they were looking at their own interests. So in 522, God raised up Haggai, and a few months later, Zechariah, to stir up the people and move them to finish that temple. For up until now, they hadn't prospered. Crops had been bad. And they simply were, times were hard, in a state of a depression. Prices were high. Just everything would seem like against them. They were expecting to come back into a almost utopia. So they were very discouraged. So in this first chapter, Haggai stirred them up to build a temple, build a house. That's what they came back for. So God rebuked them rather severely there, in that. But that left them pretty depressed. So in the second chapter here, the first part of it at least, or in the second message, what he does here is try to encourage the people. So God seeks to encourage them to go on and get the job done. I read a verse or two of that last time, but I'm going to start with chapter 2 this morning. And the 7th month and the 1 and 20th day of the month, and this would be about, about 2.5 months later than the other one there. The other was in the first day of the month, the 6th month. And this now is in the 7th, about just a few weeks, two and a half weeks.
You know the time of the year it would be in our...
In the fall, about September, October. Yes, about September, October, in the fall of the year. Now, the first speech here was on a festival day, but it was a minor one, probably the new moon. Now this one, the second, is on a very important one. And so since these first two speeches on festival days, I don't know whether it had anything to do with his name or not, but that's what his name means. It means festal. And so I'm sure there's some relationship there, but I wouldn't know what it is. But at any rate, now, and this one now is a word of encouragement here. In the 7th month, in the 1 and 20th day of the month, came the word of Jehovah by Haggai the prophet, saying, speak not as Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and to the remnant of the people, saying. Now notice he's addressing the first over here in the first speech was addressed primarily to Zerubbabel and to Joshua, the high priest, because they were responsible as leaders of the people for guiding the people in doing this work. And they had neglected it. They just hadn't done what they're supposed to have done. So now he addresses them and the remnant of the people. That's interesting. I mentioned that last Sunday. At this time, the remnant is mentioned in 4 of the 5 books that are written after the return from the captivity, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Haggai, Zerubbabel, and Malachi. One of them, I forget which one, it was probably Malachi, that does not mention the remnant, or at least it's one of them. But all the rest of them, the remnant is mentioned. Well, that's all that God ever promised to bring back, was a remnant. Well, he brought back the remnant. Now here's his question. Who is left among you that saw this house in its former glory? And how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes as nothing? Yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel, and Joshua, said Jehovah, and be strong, O Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and be strong, all ye people of the land, said Jehovah, and work, for I am with you. Now I was... closed the lesson last time dealing with that. And I think that's the secret of all successful work for the Lord. Be strong in the Lord and the strength of his might, said Paul to the Ephesians. And says the same thing here. Be strong, of course it's in the Lord's strength and might. Be strong and work. Then God says, for I am with you. Well, that's the encouraging part of it. So he seeks to encourage them here. and work for I'm with you, saith Jehovah, of whom, according to the word that I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt, and my spirit abode among you. Fear ye not. Now, if you go back to Exodus, the 19th chapter, while God brought them to Mount Sinai, and the 20th chapter, he made the covenant of the Ten Commandments. Turn to the 34th chapter of Exodus, the 1st 8 verses. Here's where he entered into the covenant and sprinkled the book and sprinkled the people with blood, bringing them into a blood covenant with God. I believe it's the 24th chapter and 45th verse of Exodus, where God said, I will be in your midst. So now God had promised to be with them as long as they were faithful to that covenant. But if they became unfaithful to the covenant, God would withdraw his presence from them, and they would be carried away into captivity by some foreign people. That's what God's calling my attention. And God said, I made this covenant with you. I'm going to keep my part of it. I kept it before. I'll keep it again now. So you have four thoughts I want you to remember. Be strong and work, for I am with you. Fear ye not. Now, I think those four principles constitute the foundation of the success of any body of God's people. It is to be strong in him, and to work, and to fear not. For I am with you, therefore fear not. There's no enemy to fear as long as God is with us and we're with him in this matter. And this is a great encouraging thought that God brings to these people in moments of discouragement. Those are the same words. You can find the same idea in the New Testament throughout there. And be strong in the Lord and the strength of his might, and fear not. God's promised to be with us and all of these things. So we just do what he told us to do, we'll come out successful. Now these next verses, verses 6 through 9, are rather difficult to understand for sure what they mean. And Kyle, in his commentary, Kyle and David series, Kyle spent almost 13 pages discussing these three verses. I waded through them. I think I've waded through them a time or two. But you get through with those, you still don't know much more than you when you started. For he's telling what this theory is and that theory and some other theory. I don't think it's all that difficult if we look at it now, and I think we can figure out what he's talking about. Now notice what he says, for thus saith Jehovah of hosts, yet once it is a little while, and I will shake the heavens and the earth, and the sea and the dry land, and I will shake all nations, and the precious things of all nations shall come, and I will fill this house with glory, saith Jehovah of hosts. The silver is mine, and the gold is mine, saith Jehovah of hosts. Now here's an interesting point. The latter glory of this house shall be greater than the former, saith Jehovah of hosts, and in this place will I give peace, saith Jehovah of hosts. I mentioned that also, that 26 times out of the 38 verses of this little book, the prophet says, thus saith Jehovah, thus speaketh Jehovah. He relied solely on what God said. He just told him what God said about it. All right, so thus saith Jehovah. Now I want to look now, drop down over here to verse 20. Now the word of God came, Jehovah came unto him a second time, unto Haggai, in the 24th day of the month, saying, speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, saying, I will shake the heaven and the earth, and I will overthrow the throne of kingdoms, and I will destroy the strength of all the kingdoms of the nations. Now that's definitely messianic. We'll notice that in a moment. It's my view that what he is saying back here in verses 6 to and 9, here the first few verses, when he says here, for once a little while I will shake. In other words, that's an expression found in so many of the prophets. God's going to shake the nations. He may shake them down to destruction, or he may simply cause upheavals among them that will cause them to do certain things. I'm going to shake them. I think that shaking began at that time, because it was at that time that Medo-Persia had conquered Babylon, and Cyrus then provided them with a great deal of, let them take back their golden cups and vessels from the temple that Nebuchadnezzar had carried away. He also gave them a certain amount of money. Then later on, the next king gave them the right to go up to the forest of Lebanon and cut down trees, bring down these trees down here. So God shook these nations then and caused them to provide help to these Jews to build the temple. For when they got back, as I said a while ago, why, they had nothing. They'd been in slavery. So they had what they brought back, some, of course, to help with them. But they needed more help. And so God shook these nations to do that. But I think the point is, I'm going to shake them up to do this now. I'm going to shake them up to destruction before the Lord comes, before the Messiah comes. Now, I'll keep that in mind as we go along. We'll see if that isn't it. I think that's the explanation of it, by just reading the text itself and passing over Kyle's 13 pages on it of confusion, at least it were to me. All right, so now then let's read that again. Now, with that in mind. So yet once more, it's a little while. I know it's a little while. Well, it was something like 500 years before the Christ came. This is 520. He came in, of course, about 5 or 6 B.C. according to the calendars. But then he didn't come to the temple for 30 more years. So you've got over 500, about 550 years nearly here, before the Lord filled the temple with his glory in the latter days here. So that wouldn't be, it's a little while here. Of course, that may be a little while in comparison to all time. That's not what they're dealing with here. All right, so a little while, and the earth and the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land, and I will shake all nations, and the precious things of all nations shall come. I will fill this house with glory, saith Jehovah of hosts. Now, here's another thing I think you want to remember, class. In studying the Bible, God never had but one house. When they built the tabernacle is spoken of in some of the Psalms there, the house of God. Then built Solomon's temple, that was the house of God. And that was destroyed. Now you build a house, this house of Zerubbabel, but that's still the house of God. Now you come over to the Herod's temple, it's still God's house, or God's temple. When you come to the church, it's the house of God, God's house. Not always, it just had one house. And that's simply the place where he meets with his people. His people as a family, the house of God is a family, and he meets with them, and here then is the temple in which he meets with them. So first a tabernacle, Solomon's temple. Now, here's another point to remember, that in the tabernacle and Solomon's temple, the glory of Jehovah filled the tabernacle. That's over in the 40th chapter of Exodus. Then in the 8th and 9th chapter of 1 Kings there, when Solomon built the temple, his temple, the glory of Jehovah filled that. That's called the Shekinah. The Jews called it the Shekinah. Right, the Shekinah filled those two temples, the tabernacle and the temple. But it's never said that the glory of God filled this temple. The glory of God then, the third time, filled the church, the temple of God. So God's glory dwells in the church today, which is presently the temple of God. So if you'll just remember that here was your tabernacle, and the tabernacle back here of Moses. Then you come on to the temple of Solomon. Then you come on to the temple here of Zerubbabel here, where God's glory didn't exactly enter. And then over here you have the church over here, the temple of God here, which is the church. Here's the church, the temple of God, made up of living stones. Right, now God took up the Shekinah, the glory filled this one, the glory filled this one. Now, but it doesn't say it filled this one, but it may have. Probably did, I don't know. It just doesn't say it, that's all I'm going by. That'd be a guess. But the next time, the latter glory of the house would be the church, because that's still the house and always just the house. God doesn't have any houses. It's always the house. Were you talking about it? Back yonder, over here, where it is, it's the house of God. And that's an interesting point. All right, so now notice what it says further then. and I will fill this house with glory, said Jehovah of hosts. Now, the extent to which he did in this one by Zerubbabel, I don't know. And I know that, and I don't think this has any reference to Jesus teaching in the Temple of Solomon. Well, that's not what he's talking about there. That's not the glory that filled that temple. That temple never was very glorious. It was magnificent, but Herod was a very wicked man. He built it there primarily to placate the Jews. And he was a Jew by religion, but he was an Edomite by blood, Herod was. Right? Now, I know the silver is mine, the gold is mine, said Jehovah of hosts. Now, the latter glory of this house shall be greater than the former, said Jehovah of hosts. And in this place will I give peace, said Jehovah of hosts. Now, I think that prophecy there is looking to this time over here. He's looking over here. Right? Now, back here, we're building this temple now. Right? So here we're... Now, he's building this. This is his house. But now, the latter glory is going to be the glory that's going to fill the church over here, the temple of the house of God over here. So, my interpretation of this, and my understanding of it is that what he's talking about here, I'm going to begin the shaking of them now, but before this comes over here, I'm going to destroy all of them. I'm going to destroy these nations. We'll get to that in the latter part of it in just a moment. Do you have any question over that? Does that sort of make sense to you there? All right? And so, you have that there. I'll fill it, and I'm going to shake these things. Oh, yeah, I want to look at another point there. I think I read this last time. That is from, look with me to Hebrews, the 12th chapter. Well, this passage is quoted here in the 12th chapter of Hebrews and applied here to the shaking of the old order of things here in the 12th chapter, if I can just step in. All right. I look down about verse 25, where the sermon starts. For if they escape not when they refuse him that warned them on earth, much more shall not we escape who turn away from him that warned it from heaven, whose voice then shook the earth, but now he hath promised, saying, yet once more will I make to tremble not the earth only, but also the heavens there. All right, now that's a... That's a quotation here from our passage here in Haggai, the second chapter in verse 6. But also the heavens, and this word yet once more, signifieth the removing of those things that are shaken as of things that have been made, that those things which were not shaken may remain. Wherefore, receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us have grace whereby we may offer service well pleasing unto God with reverence and awe. All right, so here now, as God's going to shake those nations back yonder, the time will come when he will shake the old Jewish nation and going to remove it. So all these nations that existed then will be removed, and Israel along with the others there. So those things that are made, the temporal things, would pass away. Now, in my lesson this morning on the second chapter of third chapter of 2 Corinthians, I'm going to talk about that. I'm going to point out. The Jews never did understand the place of our law. I don't know why. They just never did. And so here, when God says, yeah, I'm going to shake it and remove it, they didn't realize that. They wouldn't grasp it. They wouldn't accept that. The Jews never did, and still don't today, understand the promise to Abraham and what the law was that came in later, and the promise was fulfilled, and that's still open to them, but the old law was taken out of the way, but they couldn't comprehend it. They never could accept that. They were blinded to it. Their minds were blinded. I tell you, the hardest thing in the world to deal with in religion is a set mind. When an individual has set his mind and made up his mind that this is the way it is and this is the way it's going to be, doesn't make any difference what happens. Why, you can't do much with it. And that was the condition of the Jews. Still is. And a lot of folks that are not Jews have the same view. Well, all right. We'll pass from that. Now, any question on another point here? And in this place will I give peace, says Jehovah. What place? In this place here, when he says, the latter glory of this house shall be greater than the former, and that's when he's going to give peace. Now remember that over and over, Isaiah, for instance, in the 9th chapter, verses 6 and 7, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, of the increase of his kingdom and of peace. There shall be no end upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom to establish and uphold him, henceforth saith Jehovah. And then over in Zechariah 9:9-10 here, where behold, thy king cometh, meek and lowly, riding upon an ass, the colt, the foal of an ass. And he said, I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem, the battle bow shall be cut off, and he shall speak peace unto the nations. And the kingdom shall be from sea to sea and from river to the ends of the earth. So the peace is going to be found in the spiritual temple, the spiritual house of God. So that's why God's going to give peace in this place. Where and where alone do you find peace? What, Ephesians, the 2nd chapter, verse 17. And he, Christ, came and preached peace to you who are far off, and peace to them that were nigh. For in him we both have our access in one spirit unto the Father there. So the message of Christ is peace, peace with God, peace with one another, peace with your soul, but not peace among the nations. It's going to be in this house, in this temple, in this kingdom. Wherefore, receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, kingdom from one point of view, a house from another, family from another point, priesthood from another, all those pointing to the same body of people from different points of view. Sometime you'll hear a fellow say, well, the term kingdom and church are synonymous. No, they're not synonymous. Not synonymous at all. They refer to the same body of people, but from two entirely different points of view. Same thing with priesthood. That we're a priesthood all right, but that's not synonymous with family. So all of these terms that God uses, folks, as you're studying the New Testament, keep account of them, jot them down. All of them look at the same body of people from a little different point of view, don't you see? There's a different relationship there with God and one another. Well, all right. Now, in the 24th day of the 9th month, in the 2nd year of Darius, now this is the 9th month, the other was the 6th month, so now you're a couple of months later, the word came of Jehovah by Haggai the prophet, saying, thus saith Jehovah of hosts, ask now the priests concerning the law, saying, if one bear holy flesh in the skirt of his garment, and with his skirt do touch bread or pottage, or wine or oil or any food, shall it become holy? Now why ask the priests? Well, they were the teachers of the law. And you go back and look at the function, one function of the Levites and the priests, they were teachers of the law. Right? So ask them. They're supposed to be the ones who know now. Right? Now the idea is this. The skirt of the garment was an apron that they wore, and here they put in their this meat to be offered in sacrifice, holy meat, and they walk on, now they touch something. Does that, this is holy, does that make this bread or pottage holy? And they said no. Well, the law said that. The law, you have that in the law. Right, now you ask another question. Then said Haggai, if one that is unclean by reason of a dead body touch any of these, shall it be unclean? And the priest answered and said, yes. I said, it shall be unclean. Right, now here's an unclean person. He touches this pottage or bread or whatever. Now that makes this unclean. What's the idea there? That is, that which is holy does not make this holy. That which is unclean makes a thing unclean there. Right? So you don't become holy by simply touching something or something touching you. It's got to come from within. Alright? So now they've answered correctly. The two passages, you have them in your footnote there if you want to look at them where you'll find them there. One of them is in Exodus, and the other in Leviticus there. They're both in Leviticus. That dealt with it. All right, now what's the point he's going to make? Ask the priest this. If that which is holy touches that which is unclean, does that make it unclean? Then make it holy? No. If the unclean touches something like that, what does it? It makes it unclean. All right, now here's an application of that now. Then they look at that once more. Ask the priest concerning the law, say, one bear holy flesh in the skirt of his garment, and with his skirt do touch bread or pottage or wine or oil or any food, shall it become holy? The priest answered and said, no. No, touching it doesn't make it holy. Then said Haggai, if one that is unclean by reason of a dead body, that goes back to Numbers, I think, in Numbers 19, verse 16, I believe it is, where if you touch a tomb or anything like that, why you become unclean, that which is unclean. All right, now moving on now. If one that is unclean by reason of a dead body touch any of these, shall it be unclean? And the priest answered and said, it shall be unclean. Well, that was found in Numbers there, yes. If that becomes unclean. Now here's an application. Then answered Haggai and said, so is this people, and so is this nation before me, said Solomon. It doesn't call them his now, because they've come back and haven't done what he wants them to, haven't cleansed themselves to where he can accept them. And so is every work of their hands, and that which they offer there is unclean. For they've been an unclean land, they became unclean by their sins and dwelling in Babylon. Now they come back, but they haven't done what I told them to do. They haven't built the temple. They haven't made possible this means by which they can be sanctified again, don't you see? Be made clean. So they're unclean. And now I pray you, consider from this day and backward, before a stone was laid upon a stone in the temple of Jehovah, for all that time, when one came to a heap of 20 measures, that is, he goes out here now and they've reached it, now they're going to winter it, expecting to find 20 measures there, there were but 10. When one came to the wine vat to draw out 50 vessels, there were but 20. Now notice why that was. I smote you with blasting and with mildew and with hail and all the work of your hands, yet you turned not to me, said Jehovah. Consider, I pray you, from this day and backward, from the hour, the 24th day of the month, ninth month, since the day that the foundation of Jehovah's temple was laid, consider it. Is the seed yet in the barn? Yea, the vine and the fig tree and the pomegranate and the olive have not brought forth. No, there's nothing in the, no seed in the barn, for you had to eat it. You had to eat it. You couldn't keep it there because you didn't make enough to raise it and eat at the same time. So you had to eat up the seed there. Why? Because you came back and you haven't served God. You haven't done what you came back for. All right, now look further. Is the seed yet in the barn? No. And the olive tree, on this day will I bless you. Now that you've got the temple, you've started doing what you said you would do, what I brought you back to do. Now from this day, I'm going to bless you. What's the lesson there? As long as God's house lies, as long as I put God second and his work second or third, God's under no obligation to bless. I don't think material blessings come today simply because a man served God. I don't believe God blessed him in temporal way. I think this, though. I think that the fact that a man serves God, he'll be more diligent in the application of himself and will be rewarded and blessed through that. But I think it's through the laws of God. Back there, material blessings, and then come the spiritual blessing. Now, we had the same thing, you remember, in Joel. Here then were the locusts, they destroyed that. No, so God restored, when they cleared them out, God restored their blessings when they turned to him of material nature. Then he said, he poured out his spirit upon them. That pertained to the latter day. The spiritual followed the temple. So here you have the same thing here. Now then he's talking about, God says from here on now, it's going to be different. You'll be blessed materially. Now, then will come the spiritual. Now notice here. And the word of Jehovah came the second time unto Haggai in the 24th day of the month. That is, his morning and twice that day it came to him. Same day, the morning service and night service, in case you call it. Really wasn't there, but twice he appeared to him. 24th day of the month, saying, speak to Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, saying, I will shake the heavens and the earth, and I will overthrow the throne of kingdoms. Now, they didn't say that back here, you see. They're talking about here. Didn't say anything about the throne of kingdoms back there. What are we going to do back there? But here he said, I'm going to overthrow the thrones of kingdoms, the throne of kingdoms, and I will destroy the strength of the kingdoms of the nations, and I will overthrow the chariots and those that ride in them, and the horses and their riders shall come down, every one by the sword of his brother. All right, and that day. Now, let me look before I look at the next. Now, let's look what he says. Now, so back here, because I'm going to shake it. So here's where the shaking began here, and over here is the completion. When you come over here, in between that, he had destroyed these nations. So we say all those nations be brought to an end, you see. Well, they have a similar thought. We had a similar thought to that in Joel. For here was the blessing, but then that third chapter there, they bring them all the nation down in the valley of Jehoshaphat. There God would judge them and destroy them. All right? So all of these nations, pagan nations, were going to be destroyed before the kingdom of God came. And when it should come, then God would remove the old Jewish as well. Well, the Jews never could see that. All they could see was God going to destroy the heathen nations. They didn't realize that they were acting like the heathen, therefore would suffer the same thing. And God's not going to give special deference to me simply because I've been baptized into his family. I've got to live according to the standard. I've got to put my faith in him. I've got to live a life of faith, a life of service to him. And he will bless me. And Jesus promised, seek ye first his kingdom, these things will be added unto you. Yes, I think God's going to take care of his own. I think he'll feed us. I think he'll clothe us. What I meant a while ago when I said, I don't think I'm going to get rich. And I read a little article this past week in somebody's bulletin that they read, taken out of a paper, that Jimmy Baker there in prison there sent out a word to his Methodist people, whatever they are, holding his people there. He'd been studying his Bible since he'd been in the prison, come to the conclusion that God never promised material blessings under Christ for being a Christian. A little late with it, but I put him in prison and learned. Oh, Jimmy might learn something while he's in prison to study his Bible now. So you see, prison will be a blessing to him. God can make it better. He might learn the truth and obey the gospel someday. Who knows? Could he found out one thing, might find out two. Yeah. All right. So that's what we have here then. All right. Now let me come back now to this. In that day. Now what day is that? That's the day when God executes these judgments on the nations and brings them to an end. Those kingdoms and all that. Now in that day, saith Jehovah of hosts, will I take thee, O Zerubbabel, my servant, the son of Shealtiel, saith Jehovah, and I will make thee as a signet, for I have chosen thee, saith Jehovah of hosts. And that will be fulfilled in who? That will be fulfilled in the Messiah. Now Zerubbabel is in the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew 1. If you want to turn to it and notice that here, Matthew, the first chapter here, and he's a descendant of Judah here. And in this first chapter here, verse about 5 or 6, verse 12. And after the carrying away to Babylon, Jeconiah begat Shealtiel, and Shealtiel begat Zerubbabel, Zerubbabel begat Abiud, and he begat Eliakim, and so on, and come on down here to Christ. All right, so what? I said Matthew 1 and verse 12 as Zerubbabel in the genealogy. Alright, so God made him. He didn't become the one Messiah, but he is in the lineage through which the Messiah would come, don't you see? Well, now why didn't God say the same thing about Joshua the high priest? Because the priesthood would not come through Levi. The priesthood also would come through Christ on the throne. That would be both a king and a priest. We'll get to that in a few weeks. And we're studying Zechariah in Zechariah 6. Thus speaketh Jehovah of hosts, saying, behold, the man whose name is the branch, he shall grow up out of his place, and he shall build the temple of Jehovah. Even he shall build the temple of Jehovah, and he shall bear the glory, and shall sit, and shall rule upon his throne, and he shall be a priest upon his throne. Council of peace should be between them both. That's in Zechariah 6, verses 12 and 13 there. So Christ will be both a king and a priest. So it's Zerubbabel here that he honors here by saying that I make him a signet, because he's going to be in the genealogy of Christ. Now that's a wonderful little book, isn't it? Here now they've come back. They've neglected the temple, has been destroyed. They've come back to rebuild it. What do they do? They come back and look after their own interests. God says, my house lies waste out here. While you're looking to your own sealed houses here. Right? And God's sending them these pestilences and droughts and all that. Try to make them turn them back to God and recognize that here are reasons why that these things have come. Right? So God's trying to get their attention. And finally does. Yeah? And especially Zerubbabel and Joshua, because they were the leaders. They're the ones who ought to spur those people on, but God had to raise up a prophet to do it. And Zechariah is going to help him also. And so we'll come to Zechariah next time here. And so here then in this one, he tells them now what he's going to do. You get busy here. Those four things, try to remember. Be strong and work. I am with you. Fear not. Just keep those principles in mind all the time. It's just as true today as it were then. Just as true then. Be strong. Work. I'm with you. Fear not. What do I have to fear if he's with me? I keep those four thoughts in your mind. And he tells them here then, I'm going to shake these nations. And they're going to be provided the necessity of building this temple. Build this temple then. Right, so I'm going to provide you get busy now. They got busy. And so now then God said, I haven't blessed you because I want you to turn it back to me. Now then, he says, from now on you will be blessed. And now that I'm going to shape these nations, they're going to help you to rebuild it. And then later on, I'm going to destroy all these nations. And he did. All right, now it wasn't long after that before the Medes and the Persians had joined up to destroy Babylon, while the Persians then overcame conquered the Medes, and then later on, Alexander the Great destroyed Medo-Persia and his kingdom was destroyed. Then came the Roman. They were ruling at this time, the Fourth Empire, according to Daniel, when Jesus came, and then it was destroyed. All of those kingdoms hasn't been a world kingdom since. Men have tried to establish them. Charlemagne did. Kaiser Wilhelm did. Fellow that followed him did, others have tried to do it, but none has ever succeeded. Britain tried to do it. They tried to rule the world. They failed. And so, there's only one universal kingdom. That's God's, and it's spiritual. Jesus Christ rules in it. Now, I'd like to have some questions now, if you've got into asking. I'm sure I didn't. Something I didn't. I don't want to start in Zechariah yet. I could start in, kind of introduce him. You have any questions you want to ask? Let's pause a minute. We're all getting almost through now to this. Let's pause a minute. Let's go back and look at these prophets, these minor prophets now that we're studying. Let's review here and be in order. One thing I always believed in was reviewing. And I get through teaching a course, I used to go back now and review it. Now bring it together here. That's what I'm trying to do now. Right, if we go back and look here, we started back in 885. 845 rather, 845 with Obadiah. All right, now we're down here to 520. Over here, 520, that's, now that we're going to come on down to Malachi, he'll be about 445. So you see, when you come to Malachi 445, here you have here 400 years that you've covered. All right, we started in Obadiah. That was a prophecy against the Edomites. Destroy the Edomites, yet in Zion, that would be their hope. In other words, God opened the way there that eventually in Mount Zion, why there would be hope. There'd be hope for everybody. Right? Obadiah, then Joel. Joel was a prophecy of the locust horde against the invaded the Jews there. And then how that was because of their sins. God drove out the locust and restored the blessings, and then promised in that second chapter, quoted by Peter in Acts 2, that he would pour his spirit out upon all flesh. That would include all mankind. Don't see the beneficiaries of it. Then in the third chapter, he'll gather all the nations in the valley of Jehoshaphat. That word means Jehovah judges. And God would judge and destroy these nations, all right? So God would destroy all the physical nations, there were political nations. They exist. They were all going to come to an end. But he said in Jeremiah, but he said, I'll not bring you to a full end. The Jew would never be brought to a full end. All those nations would be brought to a full end. All right, then you come to Jonah. Now, this shows God's interest in the heathen people, the foreigners. He's the universal God, the one God. So he sent Jonah over to Nineveh to preach to the Nineveh to repent, or you'll be destroyed in 40 days. Well, they repented. Jonah is a symbol of the narrow patriotism and prejudice of the Jews. He got plumb mad about that because God spared him. God just cut down the other little vine that was over his head, but he wanted some 500,000 or 600,000 people killed out there, and God didn't do it. That shows the narrow concept the Jews always had. Pretty well illustrates it. Good lesson in Jonah. All right, then after Jonah, we came then to the sixth chapter, and who do we have then? Micah. We have Micah and Amos. Then we come to Amos. And Amos there, in his first prophecy, he prophesied of all these nations around him, all of them going to be destroyed. Now then he directs his attention to the Jews. What they've done, they have violated law, God's law, the law God put them under. So Amos then was a stern prophet of justice. Here you've got it coming, and God's going to send it to you and going to destroy this nation. That is the Israel, the northern tribe of Israel, that would be destroyed in the 8th chapter there. God's going to bring that nation to an end. Alright, then about 20 years or so later, come to Hosea. Now Hosea is a different temperament. He preaches about the loving kindness of God. God's loving kindness, and what are you going to do there? But but the first three chapters are strong and messianic. His three children all had prophetic names. You remember, as we went over them back there, that was Jezreel and Lo-Ami and Lo-Ruhama and Lo-Ami. Jezreel meant God will scatter. I'm going to scatter you people, but I'm going to bring you back, and I'm going to sow you. That word had two different meanings. That means to sow or to scatter. Well, I'm going to scatter you. You scatter seed. Then I'm going to sow you unto myself. You bring them back, don't you see? So the word means both there. All right, then there's Lo-Ruhama without mercy. There, God can't have mercy on them any longer. Lo-Ami, not my people. But the latter part of that second chapter there, well, then, those no longer would be Lo-Ami, but Ami. No longer Ruhama, but Ruhama. That is, my people who have obtained mercy. That's quoted in the New Testament, fulfilled in Christ, don't you see? All right, so here you have the messianic prophecy. Then he turns in the 4th chapter on over to the 13th. He deals now with the sins of the Samaria, as to why they're going to have to go into captivity then, why they're going to struggle. And he said also in Hosea that he'd bring this nation to an end. Now the 14th chapter is quite messianic. It's looking beyond that, what God will do later. Then comes Micah. Amos, Hosea, and Micah, they come right along in here. Now Micah was in the south, and he prophesied in Judah. Right? His message was the sins of Judah, the first part of it, how wicked they were. And then chapters 4 and 5, great messianic prophecies. Right in the middle there, of what he would do to Judah there, and her wickedness and sins, and Zion would be plowed as a field there. But not then, because they repented. But 100 years later, it was. So at any rate, you have two of the greatest messianic prophecies right here in the middle of the sins of Judah and what God was going to do to Judah over here. All right, so those three make a little cluster. They were followed then by three later, a little bit later, in the next about, nearly a century later. And these were Zephaniah, Nahum, and Habakkuk. All right, now Nahum was a prophecy of the destruction of Nineveh. That's just one theme, that's all. You're going to destroy Nineveh. All right, so Nineveh would be destroyed. All right, then you have Zephaniah. That was a world judgment. That pointed out a world judgment. All the world would be judged by God. And you're going to destroy the Assyrians and others there. But it was more of a world judgment. One of the hottest books in the Bible there. There was fire and brimstone and all that sort of thing. Right? Then after that book came Habakkuk, that beautiful little book that we just studied. Right? Now that prophesied the destruction of Judah by the Babylonians, but the righteous shall live by faith. A great book on salvation by faith, quoted three times in the New Testament there. Then the third chapter, the last part of it, well, I hear that beautiful psalm of faith. How that though the fig tree shall not flourish, no fruit in the vine, olive will fail, be no grain in the field, there'll be no flocks in the pasture, nor any herds in the stall. Yet I will trust in Jehovah. I will joy in the God of my salvation. Most beautiful psalm you'll find anywhere, of faith and of trust. All right? That now. Now the next three are after the return from captivity. Here now, first of all, is Haggai, then Zechariah, then Malachi. Now, Haggai and Zechariah build the temple. With a little messianic prophecy in Haggai, but a lot of messianic material in Zechariah. It's the most difficult of all those prophetic books. We're going to tackle it next Sunday morning. And then Malachi, the last one there. Now here in Malachi, they've gone back. They're not worshiping God acceptably. They're giving him the refuse of the flock. That's 100 years after the rebuilding of the temple. They've lapsed. Now they're still worshiping God and not idols. But it's a half-hearted, indifferent worship. And then he closed with the coming of John the Baptist. The last verse, and now the coming of John the Baptist will introduce the Messiah. So don't you see how all of these just fit right in together, and how that they're coming right on down, giving us here the conditions there, what God is doing with the people, preparing them for the coming of the Messiah, who will be the Redeemer of the world. I don't know what you think about it, but I think when our brethren have neglected the prophecies, we have neglected them. You go in that to a church, say, "Won't study the prophets." I don't want to study the prophets. Ain't got anything to do with me. I want to study the New Testament. No, they don't study it all. That's the problem.